through before everyone comes back later. Arla glanced about the empty room. Let me toss out an idea. Glover waited. What if I came along, watched the mayor do his thing? Glover's expression bordered on fearful. I'm not exactly in his good books today. No offense, but I couldn't, you know, take you in the mayor's limo, someone who's just been... Arla lightly touched his arm. Relax. Tell me where you're headed, and I'll get there on my own. I'll just observe. I won't get in the way. What better way to get a sense of the boss than to see him in action? Glover thought about it for two more seconds, then nodded. It's up near Rockefeller University. I'll text you the exact address when I know it. Arla nodded. See you there. Glover gave her a smile before spinning on his heels and running out the door. Wow, Arla thought. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. 16. Burke put Otto Petrenko's laptop, sealed in an evidence bag, on the floor in front of him as he got into the passenger seat. Delgado got behind the wheel. Both were subdued. Eileen Petrenko stood at her front door watching them through eyes filled with tears. Moments earlier, they had told her about the body found on the High Line. While a positive identification had yet to be made, evidence suggested it could be her husband. The dead man was the approximate age and weight of Otto Petrenko. There was the cobra tattoo, the shark socks. They'd attempted to ask her a few more questions. Did her husband often walk the High Line? Could he have gone there to meet someone? But the woman was too distraught to handle any more of their inquiries. Delgado turned the key and headed south. So, Otto's killer, Burke said. Somehow knows Otto's prints are on file somewhere. So we make sure we can't take any, Delgado said. But we should be able to get those prints, see if we can get a match on the tip our guy left behind. Confirmation will be nice, Burke said. But it's him. They were on their way to Petrenko's employer, Simpson Elevator Maintenance. Burke looked on his phone to see how many firms in New York did that kind of work. There's a shitload of them, he said to Delgado, who was behind the wheel. I guess if you were Otto Petrenko, an out-of-work elevator fix-it man from Cleveland, New York would be the place to go. Yeah, Delgado said. Went to Cleveland once. The downtown's got a few tall buildings. But there's this one huge skyscraper. Looks like a mini Empire State Building, Key Tower. 57 stories, tallest building in Ohio. Delgado glanced at him. Only you would know that. Their drive took them into the Hunter's Point area of Queens. Vernon Boulevard was a north-south industrial street that followed the East River just south of the Queensboro Bridge. When they found Simpson Elevator, Delgado drove through the open chain-link gate and parked between two pickup trucks. They'd learned from Eileen that the name of Otto's boss was Gunther Willem. They opened the door to the office. A chest-high counter topped with peeling linoleum greeted them. Burke rested his elbows on it and called out, "Excuse me?" to a heavy-set, gray-haired woman sitting at a desk. When she turned, Burke could see she was on the phone. She put her hand over the mouthpiece and said, "Help you?" "Looking for Gunther Willem," Lois said. "Not a good time," she said. Before she could go back to her call, Burke waved his badge. "Oh," she said. She rested the receiver on her desk and shouted, "Gunt!" From an adjoining office, a gruff voice replied, "What?" "Visitors!" There was a grumbled yet still audible, "Fuck!" And seconds later, Gunther Willem appeared. He had a crew cut, a round face, stood about 5'5", and was nearly as broad as he was tall. His meaty arms hung out from his body and seemed to bounce as he walked. He spotted Delgado and Burke and squinted. "Yeah?" Burke still had his badge out. "Detective Burke, and this is Detective Delgado?" "I'm up to my eyeballs and shit," he said. "Whatever this is, can it wait?" "No," Delgado said. Willem took a second, accepted defeat, and waved for them to follow him back to his office. He dropped himself into an office chair that creaked under his weight, and the detective sat in two plain wood chairs opposite his cluttered desk.
"I'm shorthanded, and I got the city breathing down my neck, so make it quick," he said. "This about some of the robberies along the street here? Guys stealing tools? Because we're okay. I got two Dobermans in the yard at night. Got no trouble on that score."
"No," said Delgado. "We're here about Otto Petrenko."
"Oh, him. He was a no-show yesterday and today. His wife's going bananas. He finally come home? Was he out on a bender or something?"
"We're investigating," Delgado said.
"Investigating what?"
"What happened to him?"
"What has happened to him? Because, like I said, I'm shorthanded."
"What can you tell us about Mr. Petrenko?"
Burke asked. Willem looked from one detective to the other. He quickly figured out the drill. They would ask the questions, and he would answer them.
"I don't know,"
Gunther Willem said.
"Reliable, understands how things work, you know. Some people are born with it. They look at a machine, and it's like they've got X-ray vision. They can see the parts inside it. He's pretty smart that way."
"He came to you from Cleveland?" Delgado asked.
"Yeah. The company he worked for, they were mismanaged, went bankrupt. We were hiring, so we moved here. Guy's good. Got two people out of a stuck elevator in the new Trade Center tower one time."
"Any problems?" Burke asked.
"Like?"
"You tell us."
"No. No problems. He does his job."
"How about when he was off the clock?" Delgado asked. "Any issues you're aware of? Drugs, women, trouble on the home front?"
"Like I said, nothing."
"He socialized with the other guys who work here?"
Willem shrugged.
"Some. They go out for a drink sometimes. Give each other the gears. Maybe they get together with the wives once in a while, do some barbecue."
"You part of that?" Delgado asked.
Willem shrugged.
"Not so much."
"You got along with him?"
"Yeah."
His eyes narrowed when Delgado used the past tense.
"What's this about, anyway?"
"You know anything about who he might have hung out with who's not with the company?"
Willem shook his head.
"No, not really."
He paused as if remembering.
"Well, it was that one guy."
"What guy?" Delgado asked.
"Dropped by to see him once in a while."
Burke felt as though he'd gotten a carpet shock.
"Who was he?"
"Just some guy is all. I'd see the car pull up on the street there, and Otto would go out and talk to him."
"Did Mr. Petrenko say who he was?"
"I didn't ask. You want to go talk to somebody? It's none of my business."
"Can you describe him?" Delgado asked.
Willem sighed with exasperation.
"It was a guy. What do you want from me?"
"White? Black?" she asked, persisting.
"White. Grayish hair."
"Old guy?"
Willem looked up at the ceiling as though the answer were written there.
"No idea. He was too far away to tell."
"Car?" Burke asked.
"Jesus,"
Willem said.
"I don't know. Something blue. Basic sedan, I think."
"How many times did you see Petrenko meet with this man?"
"Two? Maybe three times? Definitely more than once. I think I might have asked Otto once what the guy wanted."
"What'd he say?"
Delgado asked.
"I don't remember exactly. I got the idea maybe Otto was helping him, like he was giving the guy some kind of advice."
"About elevators?" Delgado asked. "Wouldn't it make more sense to talk to you, being the boss?"
Gunther shrugged.
"Otto knows as much about elevators as I do, probably more. And maybe it wasn't advice about this kind of work. Maybe it was about something else. Maybe it was his long-lost cousin. I don't know."
He paused, thinking.
"There was one thing, though."
They waited.
"Whenever he's come back in from talking to that guy, Otto's kind of quiet."
"What do you mean, quiet?" Delgado asked.
"Just like he's got something on his mind."
He shrugged.
"I don't know, worried-like. Maybe he owes this guy money or something and is having trouble meeting his payments, although I don't know why he'd have money problems. He's pulling down 70 grand a year from me."
"You got cameras?" Burke asked.
"What?"
"On the property. Surveillance. That would pick up someone on the street."
"Yeah, sure, of course. But the last time he was here was weeks ago. They don't go back more than 48 hours.
Delgado asked, did he ever talk about the flyovers?
What's that? A singing group?
Did Otto have strong political views?
We don't talk a lot of politics here, Willem said. Well, other than shitting all over our useless president and useless governor and useless senators and useless mayor, but that's about it. Listen, if you're looking for Otto, I hope you find him. He's one of the best guys I got, but the way you guys are talking about him sounds like something's happened.
The detectives exchanged looks. Delgado said, Mr. Petrenko is dead. Willem's face fell.
Shit. What the hell happened?
That's what we're looking into, she said. He shook his head sadly.
Man, oh man. There's so many ways to get killed on the job here, and he buys it on his day off. Was it a car accident? Something like that?
Like I said, we're looking into the circumstances.
Son of a bitch. I should give his wife a call as soon as I get out from under all this other shit that's going on.
What other shit would that be? She asked.
Like I said, the city's on my ass. When two elevators go down in 2 days, and your company was one of the ones that ever did service calls in both those buildings over the past decade, that's a fucking problem. They'll be looking for someone to blame it on, you can be sure of that. But we do good work, and it might have been another company. Or maybe we serviced an elevator there, but not that one. No one is gonna hang this on us, believe me.
Two elevators in 2 days? Burke asked. I heard about one yesterday, Delgado said. Was there one before that?
One since, Willem said. A few hours ago.
Would Otto Petrenko have worked on them? Delgado asked.
I hope no one here worked on them. But if anyone did, I hope it was Otto.
Why would you say that?
Willem shrugged.
First rule at engineering school. Whenever something bad happens, you blame it on the dead guy.
17.
You almost ready?
Eugene Clement was standing outside the bathroom of the Intermajestic hotel room he and his wife Estelle had rented for their New York stay. The door was open an inch, giving her privacy, but still allowing her to carry on a conversation with her husband.
3 minutes, she called out.
Clement knew that meant at least 10, so he stopped hovering by the door and walked over to the small desk where his phone was recharging. He detached it from the charging cord, took a seat on the end of the bed, and opened one of his news apps.
I'm starving, Estelle said.
Her words were immediately followed by the sound of a hairdryer.
Me too. If you'd hurry up, we could eat, he said, thumbing through the latest news stories.
What?
She shouted over the roar. He didn't respond. He was scanning the most recent headlines. One in particular caught his eye. An elevator accident. The second in 2 days. There were few details. The story was developing.
My, my,
Clement said softly. The hairdryer went silent.
What did you say?
Estelle asked, opening the bathroom door wide.
Nothing,
he said, turning to look at her. She was wearing one of the robes supplied by the hotel.
You know where I'd like to go,
she said.
Where? I'd like to see Radio City Music Hall. I think they have tours.
Clement nodded.
We can look into that. We could walk it from...
The room phone started ringing.
Who would that be?
Estelle asked. Clement got up, walked around the side of the bed, and snatched up the receiver.
Hello?
Mr. Clement?
A woman's voice.
Yes?
Eugene Clement?
Who is this?
He asked.
I'm Sheila Drake. I'm a booker for New York Day. It's a...
I know what it is.
Who is it?
Estelle asked. He covered the mouthpiece and snapped at her.
TV show.
Mr. Clement,
Drake said.
Here. We know you're in New York and would like to have you on the show today. We can send a car.
How did you know?
The Flyovers Group is believed to be responsible for several recent bombings and...
That's ridiculous, We can't control people saying we had anything to do with those events. They're horrible tragedies. We're all about awareness, raising issues.
We'd like to talk to you about that, give you a chance to make that point.
We're here celebrating our anniversary. I don't have time for...
Let me try to lay it out for you, Mr. Clement. We can pursue you down the sidewalk, shouting questions at you, and when we broadcast that, you're going to look like some kind of criminal. I think you'd be doing yourself a favor to come into the studio for a sit-down interview where you could make your case calmly without creating some negative impressions. What do you say?
Clement thought for a moment.
Mr. Clement?
He cleared his throat and asked,
What time?
18. Chris Valens was leaning up against the window of Blockheads, a small restaurant across from the Morningstar Cafe. He was tucked under the awning and, he thought, reasonably invisible, especially considering how wide Second Avenue was. The restaurant didn't open until 11, so no one was going to come out and tell him to move on. He had a phone in his hand, set to take photos. He would have liked a camera with a telephoto lens, but even in New York, standing on the sidewalk wielding one of those was likely to attract attention. He'd followed Barbara Matheson from her apartment to the cafe. Barbara, clearly, was a walker. She lived in Murray Hill on East 37th between Lexington and 3rd. She came striding out of her place, headed for 3rd, and turned left, staying on it for 13 blocks, then hanging a right on 50th, and east one block to 2nd. The Morning Star was right around the corner. Chris had stayed half a block behind all the way, usually on the same side of the street. Barbara gave no indication of knowing she was being followed. She never looked back. She had met Chris only the one time in the back of the mayor's limo, but he figured his bald head was pretty distinctive, so he'd worn a Knicks ball cap. And unlike when he was in the limo, when he was wearing a suit, Chris had dressed this morning in old jeans, a button-down collar blue shirt, and a brown leather jacket. It wouldn't have much mattered if he'd looked exactly as he had the day before. Like a lot of people, Barbara had her eyes glued to her phone even while she was walking. She seemed to possess a requisite skill for the modern world. She knew what was in her path without looking up. Her gift, however, had yet to be perfected. When she failed to notice a dog walker's leash stretched out across her path, she tripped and nearly hit the sidewalk. If she was at all rattled by the near miss, she didn't show it. When she turned into the cafe, he kept on walking, then crossed the street at the next light and took up his position in front of Blockheads. Barbara had taken a seat in a booth close to the window. Chris couldn't make out every detail, but at least he knew where she was. A few minutes later, another woman arrived. Younger, early to mid-20s, she slid into the booth opposite Barbara. While they talked, Valens mentally reviewed what he had already learned about Barbara Matheson. The first bit of information was probably the most valuable. This thorn in the mayor's side was not using her real name, at least not when she wrote her columns. Her real name, and the one she used for all her financial transactions, was Barbara Silbert. Valens was well aware that novelists often chose to publish their books under pseudonyms, but was that an acceptable practice when it came to journalism? Could you really take pot shots at politicians and others while hiding behind a name that was not your own? Once he had determined Barbara's true last name, he was able to find out plenty of other things about her. She was living in a sublet, paying $1,100 a month, which was a pretty good deal considering the average was more than $3,000. Just as well her rent was a deal, considering that Manhattan today was paying her a few pennies under $100,000 a year. That might have sounded like a lot to some, but you needed a lot to live right in Manhattan. Barbara paid off her cards every month and was rewarded for that with a decent credit score. What was interesting about the statements he'd been able to access was not so much what was on them, but what was not. No Bloomies, no Saks, no Nordstrom. When Barbara bought clothes, she was not extravagant. The Gap, Macy's. Maybe Club Monaco, if she really wanted to splurge. Not a shocker. All Valens had seen her in was jeans and a top and a light jacket. Barbara spent most of her money at bars and restaurants. It didn't look as though she ate much at home. Lots of diners, like the Morningstar. There were a few charges at liquor stores, so even if she didn't make many of her own meals, at least she drank at home. About 15 minutes after the younger woman joined Barbara, she got up to leave. Chris took off his right glove so that the camera icon on his phone would work when he touched it with his finger. Barbara exited the restaurant. Chris hit the button and held it, firing off multiple shots as the unknown woman stood briefly, got her bearings, and started walking south. Chris lowered the phone as she crossed 50th and hailed a cab. She got in, and the cab took off down 2nd. Barbara stayed. She appeared to be ignoring her breakfast. Chris wondered who the young woman might be. If Barbara had had a Facebook page, Chris might have found a picture of her there if she was a friend. But Barbara was not on Facebook. She had a substantial Twitter following, though. Just under 30,000. But Twitter was not typically where one posted photos of friends. It was for mouthing off. Something Barbara did plenty of. 5 minutes after the young woman left, Barbara got up, paid the bill, and emerged onto the sidewalk. Would she head back toward home? Walk to the Manhattan Today office? These days, what with half the world working from home, there might not be much reason for Barbara to show up at an actual office. She headed north. As she walked, she did the same thing she'd done earlier. She took out her phone. It was welded to her palm, Chris thought. She glanced down at it as she crossed 51st. Chris let out a derisive sigh. All these people looking at their phones when they should be watching where they're going, getting hit by cars, walking head-on into other idiots who were also staring at their phones. There was a video on the news the other day of a woman falling into some open sidewalk cellar doors, the kind you saw all over the city to accommodate deliveries. Barbara barely took her eyes off the device the whole next block, but somehow she knew there was a red light at 52nd, and she stopped instead of stepping into the path of a panel truck. Chris was only a few feet behind her, close enough to hear her phone when it started to ring. A curious ringtone at that. It sounded like someone tapping away furiously on an old manual typewriter. Barbara put the phone to her ear. As the light changed, she continued walking north. Chris couldn't make out anything she was saying, but whatever the caller was telling her was serious enough to make Barbara stop dead in the middle of the sidewalk and listen. Chris had to hit the brakes to avoid walking into her. He sidestepped around her and kept on walking. When he reached the next corner, he turned and looked back. Barbara was tucking her phone into her purse and stepping out into the street to hail a cab. Shit. He looked north and saw several available ones coming their way. 2nd Avenue ran only southbound, so the cabs were spread out across its width. One on the far side veered across, aiming for Barbara and cutting off several other vehicles in the process. Chris waved and caught the attention of another cab driver. The car swerved toward him. By the time he got into the back of his taxi, Barbara was pulling away. "Where to?" asked the driver, a heavily bearded man with one hand on the wheel and the other holding a half-eaten apple. "That taxi right ahead, that picked up that woman, I'm going where she's going." "Where's that?" the driver asked. "Don't know, just follow it." "Ah, like in the movies," the driver said, taking one last huge bite of the apple, powering down his window and tossing the core. The mini-screen bolted to the back of the plexiglass partition was playing some snippets from daytime TV. Chris made several unsuccessful attempts to mute it before giving up. He was thinking if he could get his hands on Barbara's phone long enough to fiddle with the settings, he'd be able to track her location without having to chase after her. Barbara's cab was continuing straight on down 2nd, past 42nd, past 34th, finally hanging a right on 27th. The cab went halfway down the block toward 3rd before it pulled over. "Stop here," Chris said when his own cab was about 10 car lengths back. He tossed a 10 through the partition window and was out of the car before Barbara had exited hers. He pulled out his phone and pretended to look at it while Barbara settled up with her cabbie. She got out, walked a few doors west on the north side, stopped to study the building she was in front of, and went in. Chris crossed the street so he could check out the address without standing directly in front of it. Barbara had gone into a funeral home. Clappison's Funeral Services, to be exact. 19. Arla grabbed a cab. When the taxi was half a dozen blocks from her destination, it stopped dead, not going anywhere. Traffic was insane. Arla bailed and ran the rest of the way. She jogged Central Park 3 mornings a week, so she didn't get winded, but she sweated through her work clothes. Glover had texted her the York Avenue address, and she got there before the mayor and his entourage. Along the way, her mind went back to the brief meeting she'd had with her mother. It had gone pretty much as she'd expected. Maybe it would have been better to break the news to her about her new job in an email. Face to face, things had a way of getting unpleasant in a hurry. Arla wondered if that awkwardness was what she'd wanted all along. To see the expression on her mother's face when she told her whom she was going to be working for. To revel in her shock and disappointment. Of course, if that really was why Arla had told Barbara in person, it meant her mother wasn't wrong suggesting Arla took the job just to get under her mother's skin. In the moments when Arla was honest with herself, she had to admit there was something to that. Arla had, to put it mildly, conflicted feelings about her mother. At some level, yes, she loved her. After all, she was her mother. And there were even times when Arla could understand what it must have been like for Barbara to have found herself pregnant at such a young age, to not want to have to give up a career. At least she didn't abort me, Arla told herself in moments when she was inclined to be generous. But then there were the other times when she just didn't give a shit about her mother's feelings. She should have been there for me each and every fucking day. So, yes, maybe she was sticking it to her mother. But the flip side of all this was, should Arla have turned down a great opportunity just because it would make her mother unhappy? Didn't she have her own life to live? Wasn't she entitled to make her own choices? Arla had actually been concerned when she'd applied that her potential employer would make the connection. If they found out Barbara was her mother, they'd probably deny her the job. Would that have been fair? She stopped thinking about all that when she reached the scene. York Avenue was blocked off. There was no sense of pandemonium, but there were half a dozen FDNY vehicles, as many marked police cars, and 2 or 3 unmarked ones. There was one lone TV van and not an ambulance in sight. Arla was guessing the scene had been busier earlier. A couple of hours must have gone by since the accident. Flimsy police tape served amazingly well to keep people from entering the building. Without any official City Hall ID, she was hoping she'd have some before long. Arla wasn't expecting anyone to let her pass. She'd have to wait for Glover, once he had arrived with his father and whoever else was coming, to see if she could get in. Looking south down York, she saw a black town car approaching. It stopped and Glover got out, followed by Mayor Headley. A woman Arla knew to be Valerie Langdon emerged from the other side. One of the news crews spotted their arrival and went charging in their direction. Arla expected the mayor to stop and say something for the cameras, but instead he made a path straight toward the building. As the three of them got closer, Arla tried to catch Glover's eye. But he was walking directly alongside his father, glancing down at his phone, presumably looking for updates he could pass along to the mayor. When they reached the tape line, close to where Arla was standing, she worked her way through the crowd, reached out, and tapped Glover on the arm. He glanced her way, reacting with mild surprise as though it had slipped his mind that she was going to find her own way here. "Hey," he said, blinking. Then it all came back. He glanced at Headley, who was several steps ahead, having already ducked under the tape line. "Right," Glover said, seizing the opportunity and lifting the tape for Arla. "Come on." She slipped under it. The closest NYPD officer, having seen she was with the mayor's party, made no attempt to stop her. Arla stuck close to Glover. He was her hall pass. If she got separated from him, the police might boot her ass out of there. Arla felt her pulse quickening as she headed for the entrance. Here she was, on her very first day, walking alongside one of the mayor's key advisors, strolling right past the police barricades, a dozen steps behind the mayor himself, and hoping he would not see her and ask who the hell she was, getting an up-close look at a tragedy that would be all over that evening's news. Did it get any better than this? They went into the building's large atrium-style lobby. The bank of four elevators was along the back wall, and the doors to one were wide open. Standing outside, peering in, were two men and one woman in firefighter garb, and what Arla guessed were a fire department captain, in dress blues, the FDNY patches on his shoulders, and a woman Arla recognized as the city's new chief of police. Bringing out the big guns, she thought. Sure, an elevator accident was a tragedy if someone got killed, but it wasn't exactly John Lennon getting shot out front of the Dakota, was it? As if he could read her mind, Glover sidled up to her and whispered, "She was a big deal."
"Who was a big deal?"
she asked, leaning her head toward his. "The woman who got killed. Some scientist from Russia."
"What happened to her? Where's..."
Arla stopped herself. She'd spotted what everyone was looking at. On the floor of the elevator was a bloody, pulpy mass about the size and shape of a cabbage. Next to it, what appeared to be an arm in a blue sleeve. The elevator floor was blood-covered mess. When Arla suddenly turned away, she found herself up against Glover Headley's chest.
"Oh, God," she said.
But she quickly pulled away before he could place a comforting hand on her back. Her sense of horror and revulsion was displaced almost immediately by the feeling that she needed to be professional. She was not going to be that horror movie heroine who clung to the male lead for comfort. So she spun about and looked back in the general direction of the elevator without focusing on the head and the arm and the blood.
"I will not throw up."
Mayor Headley joined the bigwigs huddled in conversation.
"What's happening?"
Arla asked Glover.
"Getting up to speed," he said. "Stay here, I gotta go."
Arla did as she was told as he went to his father's side. There was more discussion. At one point, the chief of police whispered something to the mayor while she pointed to the far end of the lobby. Arla looked that way. A man in his mid to late 30s was sitting on a lobby couch with his arm around a young boy. A father and son, Arla guessed. The mayor nodded and broke away from the crowd. He headed for the father and son and said a few words to them. The man's head went up and down once, at which point the mayor perched his butt on the oversized coffee table in front of the couch, which put him only inches away from the boy. Arla desperately wanted to know what this was about. She slipped around the outer perimeter of the lobby, coming at the couch from the other side. There was a large pillar behind it, and she took a position along one side where she was unlikely to be seen. As cover, she took out her phone and pretended to be checking something. Although the pillar blocked her view, she could make out the conversation reasonably clearly. "Your name's Colin?" the mayor asked.
"Yes,"
the boy said softly. "You know who I am?"
"You're the mayor?"
"That's right."
"My dad told me when you walked in, you're like the mayor of all of New York."
"I am."
"I thought you'd be bigger."
Headley chuckled at that.
"It's like with movie stars. When you see them in person, you wonder why they aren't 20 feet tall. The police were telling me what a brave young man you are."
"Oh,
you went through something pretty horrible. But here you are, with your dad here, and you're holding up okay, aren't you?"
"I guess."
"Missing school?"
"Yeah," said Colin. "My dad phoned and told them I'd be late."
"Well, you ask me. I think you should get the whole day off. What do you think, Dad?" Arla heard the father speak for the first time.
"Yeah, I'm thinking we might go to the movies, or Maybe the Museum of Natural History.
I like the whale, Colin said.
Oh, yeah, the whale is something, Headley said. You wonder, how can it float up there, right? The police and the fire department folks say that not only were you brave, you were very helpful to them explaining what happened.
Her head came right off,
the boy said, keeping his voice steady.
The rest of her is still upstairs in the hall. They should tell people so they don't come out of their apartments and see her there.
I think that's been done, Colin, but that's a good idea and nice of you to be thinking of other people's feelings. Anyway, I want to talk about you for a minute. I'm going to give you my card here and one for your dad. And what we're going to do is have you for dinner at Gracie Mansion.
What?
That's where the mayor, that's where I live. I get to stay there while I'm serving the people. If I get voted out in the next election, then they kick me out.
You could live with us,
Colin offered.
Could he live with us, Dad? We have the spare room.
I would imagine the mayor has a backup plan, the father said. I do, Headley said, but I'll keep your offer in mind.
Why do they call it Gracie Mansion?
Colin asked. Good question, the mayor said. It was built way back in 1799 by a man named Archibald Gracie.
Oh,
I'll show you all around when you come.
I've never been in a mansion,
the boy said. Anyway, you and your dad and your mom will be most welcome.
She lives in Omaha, the boy said. I see her at Christmas.
Okay, then, you and your dad will be my dinner guests.
What will we be having?
The boy asked.
Colin,
the father said, gently reproachful.
You don't.
It's okay, Headley said.
What would you like? Hot dogs?
I think my chef can handle that. Arla moved toward the edge of the pillar, hoping to get a peek. Headley extended a hand for Colin to shake, but instead the boy slipped off the couch and threw his arms around the mayor's neck. Headley wrapped his arms around the boy and held him for several seconds. When they let go, Headley said,
"You call me anytime."
The mayor stood, shook the father's hand, and went back to rejoin the other emergency officials. No cameras, Arla thought. No TV crews. No reporters hanging about. They were all still outside beyond the police tape. Not even Glover or Valerie Langdon had witnessed Headley's visit with the boy and his dad. They'd hired her to analyze data. But that wasn't going to stop Arla from suggesting that they find a way to highlight some other sides of Headley's personality. That was what her gut was telling her. 20. A silver-haired man in a black suit spotted Barbara Matheson entering the lobby of Clappison's funeral services and approached noiselessly, as though floating on air.
"May I be of assistance?"
he asked in a soft, unctuous manner.
"I'm looking for the Chatsworths," she said. "Ken and Sandy, parents of Paula."
"Yes, of course," he said solemnly.
"A terrible, terrible thing. This way."
Barbara realized she was speaking barely above a whisper, and this man's reply was equally sedate, even though there was no one else around. There was something about entering a funeral parlor that made people act like they were in a library. Someday, she thought, she'd like to throw a party in a place like this, take her best shot at waking the dead. Barbara followed the funeral director through a set of doors and down a hallway to a small receiving room. Broad-loomed, four big, comfy chairs, velvet drapes at the window. Barbara thought that if it weren't a room for grieving, it would be perfect for choosing which whore you wanted to spend the next hour with. In one of the chairs was a woman Barbara assumed had to be Paula Chatsworth's mother, and the man pacing the room with a phone to his ear must be her husband, Ken. Sandy Chatsworth had no phone in her hand and seemed to be staring off into space.
dazed, numb with shock, Barbara guessed. But she did look up when Barbara came into the room. Her eyes were pink and puffy.
Miss Chatsworth, she said.
Barbara,
Sandy said, suddenly focusing, extending her hands, which Barbara took in hers. Ken was still pacing the room.
Ken, it's...
He held up a finger. The introduction would have to wait. Hello? He said into the phone. Listen, I've been on hold for 15 goddamn minutes. I want someone to tell me... Hello? All I want is some answers about... He took the phone away from his ear, his mouth wide with astonishment. He looked ready to spout a series of obscenities, but then, mindful of where he was, changed his mind. I got cut off, he said, looking at his wife. After waiting that long, they hung up on me, the sons of... Jesus!
Keep your voice down,
Sandy said. He shook his head, still not believing it. Finally, he looked blankly at Barbara, as if wondering who the hell she was. Barbara reached out a hand.
Mr. Chatsworth, I'm Barbara.
Oh, right, sorry, he said, hitting his forehead with the butt of his hand. God, you got here fast.
You caught me at a good time, she said. How are you doing? A dumb question, I know, but...
They're getting Paula ready to send home,
Sandy said.
We're going to have a service in Montpelier on Friday. So many people back home want to pay their respects to Paula. Everyone is devastated.
Of course,
Barbara said.
All her friends from school, at least those who haven't moved away like Paula did, are coming. Flowers have been coming to the house. Thank goodness our neighbor's been watching, taking them in, and one of her friends set up some kind of Facebook page, but I don't know much about that.
Sandy's voice trailed off, as though she realized that flowers and Facebook pages weren't very important.
How'd you get here?
Barbara asked Ken, since he'd been so worried about the logistics of coming to New York. Flew, he said. I don't think I could have driven in this traffic. He turned his head as if looking through the walls to the street outside. Barbara nodded.
Even those of us who live here can't get used to it. She paused.
Who are you trying to get on the phone?
Someone with the city.
Who? What department?
I've been getting bounced all around. I want to talk to whoever's in charge of making sure the goddamn elevators in this city are safe. I want to know how this happened. I want to know who screwed up and got our daughter killed.
Sure, Barbara said. You want answers, I understand that.
No one's telling us anything, Sandy said.
Sometimes, Barbara said slowly, and I certainly don't want to be making apologies on behalf of the city, but things can get overlooked. I don't mean with the elevators, but maybe that's true. I mean the personal touch. People doing their jobs forget about how this is all actually affecting you. They forget there are folks like you who are really hurting and deserve to be updated on what's going on, and everyone thinks it's someone else's job to talk to family. But an accident like what happened with Paula, that's the sort of thing that's going to be fully investigated. At some point, someone will talk to you.
Oh, someone already came to talk to us, Sandy said. That's why we called you.
Yeah, Ken said.
Who?
Barbara asked. Didn't give us a name, Ken said. Sandy asked if he had a card or anything he could leave with us, but he didn't give us one. He just said he'd find a way to get in touch with us if and when he needed to.
He was, Sandy said slowly, kind of nice. I mean, he said all the right things about expressing his condolences and all. But he didn't say who he was or who he represented?
Barbara asked.
Was he someone who works here at the funeral home?
Sandy shook her head.
He made it sound like he was with the city, you know, the city government, whoever looks into these types of things.
So, what did he say? What did he want? Did he find you here?
Ken nodded. He said he'd called around, found out where Paula had been taken after she left the hospital. Sandy said.
He said he wanted us
to keep our mouths shut, Ken said, cutting her off.
What? He didn't say it like that, Sandy said. But that was the implication. Tell me what he said, Barbara said, feeling a tingling at the back of her neck. Exactly. Or as best as you can remember.
Sandy thought a moment.
He said he was very sorry for our loss. He said it was a very terrible thing that happened. He said all aspects of the incident were being looked at and... Is that the word he used? Incident? As opposed to accident?
She looked to her husband, who nodded.
Yes, he called it an incident. Anyway, he said they were looking into it and asked for our patience and said we weren't to talk to anyone about it.
Barbara blinked.
Why?
He didn't mean like friends and family, Ken said. He meant, well, people like you.
He didn't want you talking to the press, to the media?
Ken nodded. He said we needed to keep a lid on this while the cause was being determined. So anyway, this was early this morning, and after he left, I started thinking, what the hell? This is America, last time I checked, right?
Pretty sure,
Barbara said. And if we want to talk about what happened to our daughter, and we ask for answers, that should be our right. But first, I wanted to call around and see what they'd found out. Maybe find out which department that guy was from. And no one wants to talk to me. I keep getting passed from department to department.
I don't understand why they'd want to keep you from talking to the press, Barbara said. I wonder if they've approached the families of others who were in that elevator.
Sandy said.
At one point, he said they needed time to find out who did this, and then he corrected himself right away and said how it happened.
Barbara blinked.
Who?
Sandy nodded.
But he took it right back. What did this guy look like?
Sandy said.
About 6 feet tall, black hair, very short and trim, nice suit and tie, clean shaven, and his shoes,
she said slowly.
I remember his shoes. What about his shoes? They were really nicely shined. Remember that, Ken?
I didn't pay any attention to his goddamn shoes, he said.
And his car was parked right out front in a no-parking zone, she said. I watched when he left. He got in the passenger side, but whoever was driving wasn't worried about parking it illegally. Can you describe the car? Barbara asked. Any city markings on it? Did it say NYPD on the side?
Sandy shook her head no.
It was a big SUV, all black with dark windows.
Ken asked, who drives around in a car like that? A couple of people came to mind for Barbara. Well, not people, exactly, but agencies. Why would those agencies be interested in an elevator mishap? Tragic as it was. 21.
Richard! Oh, Richard!
The mayor turned when he heard his name and saw a woman heading his way. Early 80s, her slender frame draped in black silk. Her billowy pants were half covered by a blouse that came down nearly to her knees. Her silver hair was pulled into a tight bun at the back of her head, and she viewed the world through oversized, round glasses with thick rims. Heavy on the makeup, huge black eyebrows. She had her arms outstretched as she closed the distance between them. Margaret, Headley said, placing his hands on her shoulders and delivering air kisses to both cheeks. The Queen of the Sycamores. I knew I'd been in this building before. When he'd first heard the address of this second elevator catastrophe, he was sure there'd been a campaign fundraiser here. Margaret Cambridge had invited all her wealthy friends to a party so extravagant they'd all felt obliged to give the maximum contribution allowed under the law to Headley's campaign. It was a shame about the rules that prohibited massive infusions of cash from individuals. Margaret's late husband, whose name adorned half a dozen buildings in the city, had left her a billion or two, not that anyone was counting, and she'd have given Headley $1 million if she could get away with it.
I heard you were here, said Margaret. I walked down the whole way.
Good God, he said. From the penthouse?
Well, I didn't have much choice, she said. They shut all the elevators down when that one went haywire. I hope they open the others before long, because there's no way my ticker's going to survive the walk back up.
He rested a comforting hand on the woman's shoulder. I'm sure they will.
If not, a couple of those handsome firemen can carry me back up, she said, and cackled.
She then quickly put her hand over her mouth and glanced around.
I better not laugh, considering what's happened.
She lowered her voice to a whisper.
It was Dr. Petrov, wasn't it?
He nodded solemnly. A terrible loss to the scientific community, I'm told.
Maybe, but she was a total B-I-T-C-H,
Margaret said.
I don't move as fast as I used to, and she'd see me coming for the elevator, but do you think she'd hold it? Not a chance, the commie slut.
Well, said Headley. Margaret leaned in closer and whispered conspiratorially.
She was Russian, you see.
Yes, I know. I heard from the ambassador a short while ago.
I don't like it when we've got any of those in the building. They're all spies, you know. Rockefeller's full of them.
Headley smiled. Always good to be on your guard. She smiled.
Will you be at the party Thursday?
Headley had to think a moment.
Top of the park, he said.
Margaret nodded.
It's going to be the event of the year. A party in the sky.
I'll be there. Wouldn't miss it. Are you on the list? Margaret looked incensed at the suggestion she might not have been invited.
Please, she said. It's Rodney Coughlin's project. He and I go way back.
She winked. Headley grinned. He's been a close friend to me for a long time as well.
Perhaps not as close.
Margaret sniffed.
He only gave you a bigger party to show me up, you know.
Headley gave her bony arm a friendly squeeze. You could always throw another one. She laughed.
Mr. Mayor.
Headley turned. Annette Washington, the city's chief of police, the first black woman to ever hold the position, wanted his attention.
Chief, he said. Sorry to interrupt.
She tipped her head to draw him away. See you Thursday, Margaret, Headley said. Bring your dancing shoes. He pulled himself away and followed Washington into the building's management office off the lobby. Already there were the fire chief and a small balding man in his 40s and a formidable-looking man in a dark suit. Early 60s, just over 6 feet, strong jaw, the kind of guy who, if he wasn't already in charge, looked like he was about to assume that role. Headley looked at him and thought, federal. The man extended a hand. Mr. Mayor, Brian Cartland, Homeland Security. Yup, Headley thought. What was a guy from Homeland doing at an accident like this? It didn't make any sense to Headley, unless it had something to do with the fact that the person killed in this accident was some noted Russian scientist who was an expert in who the fuck knew what. What a crazy world. Where a malfunctioning elevator could lead to a diplomatic incident. Headley was betting the ambassador had been on the line to the White House before he'd called him at City Hall. That would explain Homeland's attendance.
Good to meet you,
Headley said warily. What's going on? He looked at the fire and police chiefs and then turned his attention to the small, balding man. He said,
Mayor Headley, Martin Fleck, I work for you.
He flashed a smile. Department of Buildings, Elevator Inspection Division.
So again, I ask, what's going on? Headley asked.
That's very much what we want to determine, Cartland said. Elevator accidents don't happen every day. You've had two this week and it's only Tuesday. As a matter of routine, after yesterday's incident, we got in touch with Mr. Fleck here. As it turns out, Homeland has a sub-office in that building, so our interest was piqued.
Needless to say, how an elevator goes up and down is not Homeland's area of expertise, so Mr. Fleck was able to enlighten me. It's true, Fleck said. Elevator accidents don't happen every day. Although about 30 people on average are killed in elevator mishaps every year, and some 17,000 Americans are injured on an annual basis, although those numbers also include escalators.
Okay, said Headley slowly.
And of those 30 who are killed, probably about half of them are going to be folks who work on them. An elevator technician slips and falls down the shaft, or he's at the base of the shaft and an elevator comes down and crushes him, or he gets caught between the moving parts. All totally avoidable, but someone gets careless. Horrible when it happens, but not totally shocking, given the dangerous conditions in which an elevator technician works. Headley was getting impatient, but decided to let Fleck continue with Elevator 101. Stats show that one in every 12 million elevator trips results in a mishap, and often that may be as simple as a door failing to close or open properly, Fleck continued. When passengers in an elevator are injured, it's not usually a fault of the elevator itself. For example, a woman goes into an elevator with some big flowing scarf, and it gets caught in the doors, and the elevator starts to rise, and that scarf is stuck at the floor below, and the other end is still wrapped tightly around the woman's neck, and
I get the picture, the mayor said.
Sometimes you get an idiot who wants to elevator surf, and
I'm sorry, what? Asked Headley.
Elevator surf. Gaining access to the shaft and riding on top of the car for the thrill of it, kids do it. The problem is there are cables galore and parts that stick out, and the cables are greasy, and you're either going to fall and get caught between the car and the shaft, or
just tell me what happened here, the mayor said.
Well, Fleck said, Petrov, this Russian science lady, she's partly to blame.
Headley gave the Homeland agent a weary glance.
If it was her fault, why are we all standing here?
It wasn't her fault that the elevator stopped, Fleck said. It was her mistake to climb out. Actually, if she'd stopped there, she'd have been okay. But according to the boy, she reached back into the opening for her purse, and that was when the elevator suddenly continued its descent, and she got caught and, well, lost her head. But the fact that the elevator stopped in the first place is the thing we're looking at.
We think it may have been sabotaged, Cartland said.
Sabotaged how?
We're not sure, the Homeland Security agent said. Not sure. It might have been hacked. The mayor's eyes widened.
Hacked? Is that possible?
Yes, Cartland said. It's not an easy thing to do, but it can be done. The elevator system here was recently upgraded, loads of high-tech stuff. The more high-tech things get, the greater chance there is of messing about with them. Those old-fashioned ones with the big metal gates you had to close that needed a guy to run them. Those didn't get hacked.
But you don't have any actual proof that that's what happened, the mayor said.
No, said Cartland. This time, Fleck weighed in.
In yesterday's incident, as far as we can tell, given that there are no survivors, the car started acting like it had a mind of its own, passing floors riders had pressed buttons for. That part sounds a bit like a hack, like someone was messing with the system. They've got an upgraded system over there, too, so up and down they went, and then when they were around the 20th floor, the car plummeted. That suggests a total override of the system.
How could that happen?
If someone had control of it, someone outside the elevator itself?
Headley looked at Cartland.
What the fuck are we looking at here?
The Homeland Security agent looked grim. We're still assessing, but we have to consider the possibility that one or both of these elevator accidents were not accidents at all. Headley studied the man.
So if they weren't accidents, who's doing it? If you're here, does that mean terrorism? Does ISIS know how to hack elevators? They've decided to stop running cars and trucks into crowds? Do you know how ridiculous that sounds? I mean, as far as terrorism is concerned, it's about the most inefficient method I can imagine. And not only that, the level of expertise required would be off the scale. You want to kill a bunch of people, there are lots of easier ways to go about it.
I don't disagree, Cartland said. But it doesn't change the facts that have been presented to us.
Let me see if I get what you're saying. Someone might have tampered with one or two elevators. Someone might
have hacked in or sabotaged the mechanism, but you really don't know yet. Has anyone claimed responsibility?
Cartland shook his head. Not for this, specifically.
Is there anyone you think might claim responsibility?
We have been dealing lately with an uptick in domestic terrorist acts in Seattle, in Portland, just yesterday in Boston. The group responsible for those incidents might be looking for a higher profile. They're very much on our watch list, but there's no shortage in this country of crazy individuals with an axe to grind. But so far, no one's taking credit. Cartland shook his head again.
Could it be you guys are blowing something out of proportion, looking for something that's not there to justify your existence?
Cartland clearly did not think that deserved a response and said nothing.
What would you have me do? Headley asked. Tell New Yorkers to stop using the elevators until further notice? You have any idea what kind of chaos that would create in a vertical city like this? The entire fucking town would come to a halt.
We should show him,
Fleck said to Cartland.
Show me what?
The mayor said. Cartland said, let's take a walk upstairs. There's something you need to see. 22.
Welcome back to New York Day, said the woman, looking into the camera. I'm Angelica Briscoe.
Briscoe adopted a stern expression.
A bombing in a Seattle coffee shop. More bombings in Portland and Boston. People dead and wounded. Disgusting, cowardly acts. What do they have in common, and what do these cities have in common? Many things, of course, but one is that they're coastal cities, and that makes them, symbolically, targets for those who identify themselves as members of the Flyovers, a domestic extremist group whose somewhat self-deprecating name is actually a shot at the so-called coastal elites, the people who fly from New York or Boston to Los Angeles and San Francisco and back again. They feel these elites literally look down on the rest of the country and hold the people who live there in contempt. Our guest here today is the head of the Flyovers, Eugene Clement. Mr. Clement, thank you for coming in to speak with us here today.
The camera panned to the other end of the desk where Clement sat, grim-faced.
I think your characterization of what the Flyovers stand for is grossly unfair and inaccurate,
Clement said. Briscoe looked him straight in the eye and said,
The Flyovers has been branded by some as a terrorist group.
Is it?
Absolutely not. That's a reckless assertion, he said. The Flyovers is made up of good, decent American citizens who want nothing more than to be recognized for their contributions to this great country.
You heard what I said off the top. Law enforcement officials say these bombings in various coastal cities are very possibly the work of Flyovers' adherents.
The blood vessel in Clement's right temple could be seen pulsing as he leaned forward in his chair and said,
These bombings are despicable, horrible acts. To even suggest they have anything to do with us breaks my heart, outrages me.
So, the Flyovers eschew violence as a means to highlight their issues?
Without question, he said.
And yet, you were among the armed militants involved in the occupation of a national wildlife refuge in Colorado last year. Are you going to tell me that wasn't a violent act?
Eugene Clement appeared slightly taken aback by the question. He took a moment to respond.
A couple of things, Angelica. First, that was not an event connected in any way to the Flyovers. Second, no one was injured in that, well, what you call an occupation. I would call it a demonstration against abusive federal authority. Washington controls millions of acres of land in the state that it has no business being involved in. That was a protest aimed directly at the federal government, which, thank God, did not come in with guns blazing and kill a peaceful protester as they did at a similar demonstration a few years ago.
But there's a lot of crossover in beliefs between those groups and the Flyovers.
Some, perhaps, he acknowledged. But that's very true on the left as well. We haven't held all liberals to account for the actions of the Black Panthers or the Symbionese Liberation Army, or more recently, groups like Antifa.
Yes, but what the flyovers is seeking to address is the current cultural divide, not government interference in our lives. Our goal is an attitude change. We want to educate the Americans living along the coasts, the folks who seem to be unaware that there is another America. We're more than a caricature, more than a bunch of NASCAR-loving, rib-eating, beer-swilling rubes. Not that being a NASCAR-loving, rib-eating beer drinker is anything to be ashamed of.
He managed a rueful smile.
That sounds like a great afternoon to me. Anyway, the coast is something of a metaphor. There are people throughout the country who hold the views we seek to challenge. You can find them right here in New York, I would imagine.
But isn't that exactly what you have reduced the so-called coasters to? A cliche. Sushi-eating, latte-drinking, gluten-avoiding, Prius-driving elites?
Clement shook his head.
Not at all. As I said, we're just trying to educate.
By blowing things up.
Clement's cheeks flushed.
No. That greatest generation you've heard so much about, you'll find it in the heart of the country. And you'll find their sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters there, too. But some of this country's most prominent politicians seem to have forgotten that. Only a couple of years ago, that woman who nearly became president, who even won the popular vote, said, and I quote, "I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward."
He sneered.
You know, coastal places. What an insult to the rest of the country.
You have to admit that many of the people who swear allegiance to the Flyovers organization, that's laying it on a bit heavy. We hardly have a pledge of allegiance. Many of your followers, your adherents, those that speak their mind on your comments page, have advocated the kinds of terrorist acts we've seen lately.
You know, Angelica, many urbanites believe the only amendment we care about is the second one. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. We believe, as all good Americans do, in the First Amendment, freedom of speech. I may not like what some of these people have to say, but I would defend their right to say it, just as I defend your right to speak to me in condescending and belittling terms.
The host was unfazed.
Some of the things your followers say constitute hate speech.
Clement frowned.
What is hate speech, exactly? It's hate speech when you don't like something I've said. But when you attack me for what I said, can't your words also be defined as hateful?
He leaned in again.
What we need to do is find common ground. You speak your mind, and I'll speak mine. And that way, we'll find a way to meet in the middle. Think of all the things that we have in common. We want good jobs. We want the best for our families. We want a secure future.
You make yourself sound like a peacemaker when the FBI and Homeland Security have suggested the exact opposite. Many of your members also belong to white supremacist, white nationalist organizations. Some are members of the KKK.
Clement shrugged.
And I can find you plenty of people of color who share their sentiments when it comes to coastal folks looking down their noses at us. That's what I mean about meeting in the middle, which is an apt metaphor when you're talking about the middle of the country. We've got people talking to each other who otherwise might never do so. We want to bring people together, to start a dialogue. We won't get anywhere throwing insults at each other.
The interviewer grinned slyly. If you can take a mild criticism here, Mr. Clement, wouldn't it be more accurate to call your group the Flown-Overs, since that's who you are? It's the coastal folks who are flying over you.
Clement gave her a withering look.
And there you have it, in a single question. The contempt, the we're so much smarter than you comeback.
Briscoe suddenly looked regretful, aware she had gone too far.
She touched her ear, an indication she was getting a message from the control room.
Mr. Clement, we've run a bit over here, but I wanted to thank you for agreeing to come in and speak to us.
He said nothing.
I do have one last question.
Of course.
Given the way your organization feels about coastal cities and the people who live there, what are you doing in New York?
My wife and I are celebrating our anniversary. Or we were until you dragged me in.